I'm Brendan Byrne, in for Matthew Petty, and this is an encore presentation of Intersection. When it comes to religion, there's been a rise of the nuns. That's N-O-N-E-S, those who consider themselves atheist, agnostic, or non-affiliated with a religion. A quarter of adults, and even more millennials, clocked in as a nun. We're taking a look at the state of faith and revisiting a conversation from last January with the Rabbi Steve Engel, Imam Muhammad Musri, and Reverend Brian Fulwider. Each week, a rabbi, a reverend, and an imam get together to talk about faith, culture, and society. The show, Friends Talking Faith with the Three Wise Guys, tackles the intersection of faith, society, politics, and current events, like mass shootings, sexual assault, and hate speech. The Wise Guys are here in the studio, where we'll take a deep dive into the state of faith. Are people leaving their houses of worship? What role does religion play in society? And how can faith leaders help fix social issues? Did you grow up in a church but no longer attend? Why? Do you consider yourself the so-called nuns, atheist, agnostic, or non-affiliated? And how does religion fit into the bigger picture of your community?
Well, joining me in the studio is Rabbi Steve Engel. He serves as the senior rabbi of Congregation of Reform Judaism, Reform Synagogue affiliated with the Union for Reform Judaism. Rabbi, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here this morning.
Also, Reverend Brian Fulwider. He's founding president and CEO of the nonprofit Building Us. Rabbi, or Reverend, I'm sorry. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you. We're interchangeable. Thank you, Brendan.
And Imam Muhammad Musri, founder and president of Islam Inc., a national organization representing moderate Muslims. He's also president and senior imam of the Islamic Society of Central Florida. Good morning, Imam.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Well, Pew released a study in 2014 looking at the rise of the nuns. That's N-O-N-E-S, those who are atheist, agnostic, or non-affiliated with a religion. And a quarter of adults and even more millennials clocked in as a nun. So let's start with that. A couple of questions. I'm going to throw this one to you, Rev, first. What's going on here?
Well, we're seeing a decline in the number of folks who say they affiliate religiously. It's interesting, though, from 07 to 14, when Pew did the research study, 97% of those who were religiously affiliated still say they believe in God. The number is declining some of those who say they believe in God, even among the nuns. But what we're seeing, I think, is a lot of questions about the relevance of religion in people's lives. And so people will say, well, I'm spiritual but not religious, SBNR we call them, or nuns, N-O-N-E-S. And so I think there's a real challenge to religious folks to address this.
Mm-hmm. Rabbi?
Well, I think if we look, we ask the what, and now we ask the why. I think that there have been a lot of people, and I can understand actually as a religious leader, sometimes I'm rather embarrassed and humiliated by some of the things that happen in religious institutions. So I think we have to make a distinction in some ways between a religion, faith, and also a religious institution. People are becoming disenchanted with some of the things they see that come out of religious leaders' mouths, mm-hmm. Some of the things that happen in religious institutions, and it's really turning people off, particularly young people who really are not really into listening to authority, don't want to be told what to do, and sort of coerced into a certain position. Mm-hmm. So it's understandable that some of the people, there are certain places, synagogues, church, mosques, that I wouldn't want to go to either, mm-hmm. truthfully.
We'll dive into that in a moment, but Imam, I want to just ask you the same question. I mean, are you seeing this same decline in folks that are coming to the Muslim faith or coming to mosques and coming to your services?
I'm not seeing it, really. I'm having kind of the opposite problem, expansion. But in general, the millennials are shifting from the brick and mortar kind of religion and institutionalized religion to they are flexible, they're on the move, they want answers under their fingertips right now. So just like people used to watch regular television and cable, now they watch their news or whatever they want on their cell phones. Mm-hmm. So religion has to adjust to the millennials and where they demand the service to be delivered. But on the other hand, we cannot deny the fact that many people, as the rabbi said, they are disenchanted with religion altogether because religion has limited itself and have become politicized. And it's not giving the satisfactory answers today to people who are educated and going to college And they need more information today than the limited old stuff that religion institutions are providing.
Mm-hmm. Is religious institutions, are they evolving in this respect, Rabbi?
Well, I think some are and some aren't. I think that the ones that aren't are going to be left behind. We already see a trend of congregations merging. I'm speaking from now my perspective, but I don't think it's different in other faiths as well. We see conglomeration of places financially strapped because they're losing membership. We see places going out of business, religious institutions going out of business. So, yes, religion, institutionalized religion is definitely on a downward spiral. But those who are creative and inventive and are rethinking themselves, I think one of the things about religion is good religion is that it reinvents itself as times change. It keeps up. It adapts. It responds to modernity rather than just saying, you know, it's their problem, not ours. Mm-hmm. And those institutions, I think, will continue to exist. The other ones will fade away.
Mm-hmm. Rev, even evangelicals who are building these mega churches are seeing this decline. I mean, is this a real crisis in the Judeo-Christian faith?
Well, I think what's happened is people are evolving in terms of their own thinking. And so, as both of my colleagues have said, there's just a lot of questions about some of the pat answers that people are given. And not to be unkind, but conservative Christianity tends to have fairly concrete, granite sort of like answers. Those that would be called progressives tend to explore more, listen to more questions, and be willing to be much more flexible in terms of how we interpret and think about religion. So, I mean, just to take an example, there's a lot of folks in particularly the younger group who are saying, a virgin birth, really? Come on.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas progressives will say, okay, let's talk about that. Let's admit that that sounds pretty unlikely. You know, a more conservative Christian would probably say it's an absolute must to believe that and so on. And I think that creates a real chasm for people who are thinking about deeply what life means.
Mm-hmm. Now, for folks that haven't listened to your show, it is the three wise guys, the rabbi, a reverend, and an imam. Rabbi, how do you incorporate some of these other viewpoints in your show, the atheists, the agnostics, the non-affiliateds? How do you bring in that point of view to your conversation?
Well, I think interesting that you asked the question because we know demographically that a good percentage of listeners are non-religious people who are not affiliated, who are agnostic, who are atheist. And you might say, why would someone listen to a show on religion?
Mm-hmm.
So I think we bring them in because our conversation is, first of all, not judgmental. It's open. It's intelligent. It's well thought out. It's based on religious principles. And there are some. The interesting thing is they can't figure out, because sometimes when someone is an agnostic or an atheist, part of what drives them to that position is being really turned off by religion
mm-hmm.
and by religious leaders. And they listen to us and they say, wait a minute, this doesn't sound like the typical religious mm-hmm. show or leader that we've heard. And so I'm interested in these guys and what they have to say. And we've invited even atheists and agnostics to come on our show and be involved in the conversation, because we feel like all voices are legitimate, even those who don't claim any religion at all.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We're like the U.S. Constitution in regard to elected office. There's no religious test.
Mm-hmm.
So for our guests, we don't care if they have a faith or not. If they want to talk about a faith perspective, that's fine. But a lot of our guests don't have a religious affiliation. They come out of a secular viewpoint. And we want to talk about common values. And we bring the religious conversation to the table. So that's our job, is to say, does our faith say anything about this? But a lot of our guests don't have any religious affiliation, so we may not be specifically talking about non-believers, but we may be talking to non-believers a lot of the time.
Imam, as someone who represents the Muslim community, I mean, do you use the show as a way to kind of educate folks as to what these different religions are and how they can all exist in the same community?
Yes, indeed. There are so much in common between our faith. And even with those nuns who, N-O-N-E, mm-hmm. as the people who may disagree with religion, but they don't know that we share with them so many timeless principles of justice and peace and love and good neighborly relations. And we bring that out in the show. We want to show the people that We don't have to be divisive to be religious. Mm-hmm. We are so much alike than we are different.
We're going to go to the phones now. We're going to listen to Andrew. Andrew, you're on the air. What's your question or comment for the Wise Guys?
I just wanted to say to you guys, I love listening to the show, by the way. I'm not, you know, I don't have a set religion. I'm definitely spiritual. I really think in today's society, I'm 18, I'm in college now, and I really think that it's hard for me to actually pick a religion because there's so many options, there's so many, you know, different paths that I could follow and different ideas that I like from all three religions. And I was raised in a church community, and the conservative Christian values, it's just not for me. I'm always looking for something that's helping everybody.
Well, thanks for your comment, Andrew. Let me kick that to you, Rev. I mean, is there too many options out there for people these days?
Well, I don't think so. I think options are wonderful. And I want to say to Andrew, first of all, thanks for listening to the show. But secondly, it's exciting to hear from a younger person that he is thinking deeply about these issues and has a spiritual perspective. And that's really what we're hoping for, is that whether somebody kind of aligns themselves with an institution of religion, that they are living a life that has depth and meaning. And, you know, one of the great values of a religious organization is you get community in that. And that's a good thing and a positive thing, where hopefully people are helping each other to really live out those values. So there's reasons for local congregations, mm-hmm. but we're grateful for people who are really thinking about these things deeply.
Let's take another call here. We have Lauren. Lauren, you're on the air. What's your comment?
Hi. I just want to say I agree so much with everything that you guys have talked about so far, that I was raised in a conservative Christian family. We attended a few churches in the area, and I realized pretty quickly that that kind of mindset just wasn't for me. I'm in my mid-30s now and have my own family, and we are nuns. I mean, we don't practice any religion. We kind of looked for things, but overall, religion just seem like they view the world very black and white, and the older I get, the less and less that makes sense. So in my opinion, I think that a lot of religions just have a really big uphill battle in kind of regaining the mindset of a lot of people in my generation.
Well, thanks for your comment, Lauren. Imam, is that the case? I mean, is faith black and white, or do people need to realize that there's all sorts of different avenues that you can go when it comes to faith and exercising that faith?
Well, faith is not black and white. It is evolving, as the rabbi said. Over thousands of years, faith has survived and answered the tough questions in life. But the problem is in those who interpret the faith nowadays, they are lacking and they want to interpret it in black and white. And therefore, they're not able to answer the fast-changing, you know, fact of life today. Everything is moving at the speed of light, and yet faith is still stuck in the past. So faith will survive. New generation of faith leaders will emerge that will really bring out the timeless principles in faith and how they apply to our world today.
We're going to go to Twitter here. We have a comment from Lauren who says, "The answers to the questions I thought were because of God can be answered by science. Why are people good? It makes evolutionary sense to be kind to each other. How is the universe created? I resent the argument that millennials just don't listen to authority. I think there are nuns mainly because we have more access to scientific information than any other generation. It's at our fingertips when we have questions." Now, I want to kick this to you, Rabbi, because I don't think a lot of people know this, but you have a background in physics, right? You are a scientist.
Right. I actually have a degree from Rutgers University in physics. So mm-hmm. I have a physics background. And I think here's where we have to kind of get the word out, because I think all of our callers so far have made certain suppositions, which I understand why they do, about religions, because they have experienced certain churches or mosques or synagogues, and they make the supposition that that's what represents religion. But there's a whole world of religion out there that's open, that's embracing, that's open to different, is diverse. And there are actually most religious institutions and leaders that I know have no problems of putting science and religion together. I, as a Jew personally and as a Reform rabbi, understand that science and religion can go side by side. In fact, in the 12th century, some of our great rabbis who were scientists said, if science proves it, it is true. Mm-hmm. If religion doesn't understand it, religion needs to sort of take a re-look at itself. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to sort of throw it out to all the listeners out there that there are, if you look and search wide enough, you can find a religious community, a religious institution that will be open to your views. Mm-hmm. The saddest thing is sometimes some people come to say to me and say, I went to this place and I just found this. And I say to them, there are many different kinds of places. You can find a place of your liking that will meet your needs. It won't answer every single thing. Mm-hmm. But part of, I think, what we talk about in religion is it's not being given answers. It's really the quest that's mm-hmm. most important. And someone that says that Judaism says exactly this about this, walk away from that place right away, because no religion has all the answers. It should be a place of exploration, a place of questioning, and a place of challenging people.
We're going to go back to the phones. I have, I believe it's Noel calling. Noel, you're on the air.
Oh, good day. And it's a pleasure to speak with you, gentlemen. I listen to your show regularly. I'm an atheist, a lifelong atheist, and I'd be interested in your show covering more about the intersection between more secular beliefs and religion and how they affect society.
What do you guys say to that?
Well, I think one of the things that we really understand is that, for instance, the Humanist Manifesto, if you take that and line that up alongside of what all of our religions in their very best kind of understanding of religion teaches, we're going to find a lot of common ground. We're going mm-hmm. to find that we believe many of the same things. We value many of the same things. Principles are similar. We may say there is a God aspect to this in some way, but that even is interpreted very broadly, and we don't all agree on what we even mean when we say God. So it's important, I think, for us to have these conversations, and I take that challenge seriously. I want us to make sure that we are understood as being in conversation with both people who may claim some faith understanding and those who claim no faith understanding, but are trying to live a life that's good and positive and helpful to mm-hmm. humanity.
Imam, are you seeing the U.S. becoming more secular, kind of like it is over in Europe? I mean, is that the case here?
It is, and it is inevitable, because as science advances and people minds are opened, they need more sophisticated answers that are compatible with the scientific findings, and old interpretations won't do enough. And therefore, many people may migrate out of institutionalized religions and be on their own in the wilderness looking for these answers. But I believe at some point, you know, religious leaders and scholars would catch up and bring the two back together. Mm-hmm. Because it happened over generations.
Here, I just want to say an interesting statistic in the latest Pew Research shows that in 2015, 16% of the world population said they were nuns, didn't affiliate. The projection is by 2065, that will be down to 13%. The world is shrinking in terms of nuns, and that includes in places where there's high commerce, like India. They have a very different understanding of religion, much more open often than some of the U.S. Very conservative evangelical type religious structures. So people are experiencing religion in different ways around the world.
I have another tweet. An elder millennial here, she writes, was turned off by the church at a very young age when my questions were met with a brick wall. I felt alienated. I now identify as a pagan-flavored agnostic. So we're getting all sorts of people that are tweeting us. Go ahead and join the conversation at WMFE Orlando. We're going to go to Alex now. Alex, what is your comment?
Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you so much for talking about this subject. I think it's really important. Just wanted to comment on the LGBTQ interaction with religion. I grew up Jehovah's Witness, and I am the second person to come out in my family, and both of us have been essentially cast out from the immediate, from the extended family. Fortunately, my own parents support me, but my cousin, who came out first, didn't have that luxury. Just last year, we ended up going to a wedding where we were the only family on her side of the aisle. And I think that is what's pushed away a lot of millennials, just the traditional view that homosexuality, transgenderism, and all things like that are bad. And I myself am transgender, but I recently got a letter from my own family being encouraging, but with the subtle hint that if I do come back, I need to denounce who I am. And that's a tough thing to juggle.
Mm-hmm. Well, Alex, thanks for sharing that. I'll kick it to the panel here. I mean, especially in Central Florida, where we are a very LGBTQ-friendly community, how does the church interact with that, Rabbi?
Well, I think, again, this is a question of, like, what we like to call bad religion and good religion. We just label it that way, is that there are religious places where you're not welcome. There are religious places that are very judgmental. But we believe there are a lot of places, like our places, where someone who's LGBTQ would be welcome. In my congregation, for instance, we do same-sex marriages. We do baby namings. Our denomination is the largest in America, the Reform Movement, and it's been open for 20 years, 25 years, openly expressive of welcoming people. And I'm sure that the reverend and the imam would tell you that there are places in those denominations. So, again, it's this idea like we judge religion by the worst we see about it, and we don't always see the full spectrum of religious institutions. Mm-hmm. It makes me sad that a religious institution would turn away a person based on their sexual orientation. To me, that's not a religious principle. So there are many people, many clergy leaders like myself that would feel the same way. So I just throw it out there to the listener, you know, in my compassion and what he's struggling with, but there are religious people who will be welcoming to someone who is LGBTQ, whatever denomination, whatever place in the world they come from, whatever their values are, they'll be welcome in the community. They just have to find that community. But don't be turned off because one place turned you off and now you label all of religion as turning people off.
Imam Muhammad Musri, in the wake of the Pulse shooting, you were out there on the front lines dealing with stereotypes of your religion. I mean, how is it to be a Muslim here in Central Florida with the Pulse shooting and having an LGBT community? How do you interact with the community in that respect?
Being a Muslim is very tough. The hate doesn't stop. We get regularly every day hate mail and emails and threats on phones. And, you know, I get more nasty messages on my answering machine than I get, you know, questions. And there's a lot of people who don't understand, don't know, and they judge. As the rabbi said, unfortunately, it's the trait of our time. However, I think there is a lot of hope. Our community, in Central Florida is one great community, and we have seen how Orlando was united and they came together. The faith community, the political, everybody came together, and that is a wonderful sign.
Mm-hmm. In the last few moments that we have here, I mean, how can the faith community help make this community better, Reverend?
Well, I think one of the things is to admit our shortcomings when we have them, and to really listen to the deep teachings of our faith, just in response to our caller, our transgender caller, just a minute ago. I mean, we can talk about how there are welcoming places, and there are. I'm UCC, United Church of Christ. That's a welcoming group. But we have a lot of not welcoming and not nice behaving religious people. And if they're listening right now, stop it.
Reverend Brian Fullwider, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We have Rabbi Steve Engel.
Great to be here this morning with you, Brendan.
And Imam Muhammad Musri.
Was very happy to be here.
That interview first aired on Intersection last January. And you can catch Friends Talking Faith with the Three Wise Guys every Tuesday evening at 6:30 here on 90.7 News. Still to come, of the women entering science, technology, engineering, and math careers today, 45% of them will be gone from the STEM field by the time they turn 40. Some experts believe it could be partly because of a lack of mentors and role models early in a woman's career, including at high school and college. We'll take a closer look at the gender and race disparity in engineering faculty statewide when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Brendan Byrne, in for Matthew Petty. Of the women entering science, technology, engineering, and math careers today, 45% of them will be gone from the STEM field by the time they turn 40. Some experts believe it could be partly because of a lack of mentors and role models early in a woman's career, including at high school and college. From the Education Desk this week, we're taking a closer look at the gender and race disparity in engineering faculty statewide. I spoke with 90.7's Nicole Darden-Creston about the demographic makeup and salaries of college faculty last March as part of 90.7's Sunshine Week series focused on public records requests.
You took a look at the faculty in the engineering field around the state. Where did this idea come from?
Well, when the newsroom decided to take on this Sunshine Week project, I was trying to figure out just what I would cover. So I reached out to a source I've worked with in the past. Pamela McCauley is a professor of engineering at the University of Central Florida, and she does a lot of work with women engineers and developing their STEM careers. And she shared this startling statistic.
The statistic is that of the women who are entering STEM careers today, approximately 45% of them will be gone from the field by the time they turn 40.
And while there could be a host of reasons why this is happening, work-life balance, career changes, etc., McCauley says a lack of mentors and role models early in a woman's career, including high school and college, is partly to blame. She told me she didn't have too many women engineers to look up to as she went from kindergarten to grad school, and having those mentors early are crucial in keeping women in the engineering workforce.
So they can actually see people who look like them. So they see women who are engineers, who are scientists, and actually see them enjoying their careers and doing well. And then having an opportunity, and that's just a role model, but a mentor, someone who can help shepherd you through the process.
So if I'm following you here, your story is going to look at role models in engineering. How are you going to quantify that with public records? How does that work?
Well, you're right. So here's the great thing about public records and the state of Florida, as I'm sure our listeners are finding out this week. Florida has a very broad set of public records laws. So state employee information, including college faculty, is available publicly and quite easy to access. Just head over to floridahasarighttoknow.myflorida.com. That lists state contracts, state employees' salaries, and state employee regulations in a free-to-use, easy-to-access website. So everything from the groundskeeper to the dean of the university is available to the public to access salary information.
A quick click over to that website and we can find out how many women engineering professors are at each college?
It's not that simple. So the state records on that website list the names, salary, position, et cetera, but no demographic information. Now, that doesn't mean it's not available. All it takes is a request to the university's general counsel. Basically, it's a legal department with a request for the information we're looking for. So I reached out to four colleges. Those were the University of Central Florida, University of Florida, Florida State, and the University of South Florida. All the way back in February, asking for a list of faculty over the past 5 years, their position, gender, and salary. And since I was already making the request, I went ahead and added race, too.
So what did you find?
Well, I received responses from UCF and FSU. Records for UF and USF wouldn't be available in time for this story. So after throwing the data into Excel, I started to see what McCauley was talking about. At Florida State, 18% of the teaching faculty of its College of Engineering was female. At the University of Central Florida's College of Engineering and Computer Science, that number was around 17%. Now, that's nowhere near the actual makeup of gender in our society, right?
Right.
Well, according to the Society of Women Engineers, the U.S. average for faculty is about 15%, and that's for all the faculty.
So by that standard, technically, the Florida schools you looked at are slightly ahead of the curve.
They are, and they showed growth in female faculty over the 5 years of records that I looked at. But I want to share something else I found in the records. Remember when I said I made the request I asked for race, too?
Mm-hmm.
Well, after playing around with the data in the records, I started to see other underrepresented groups. At Florida State, 11% of the engineering faculty were Black and 7% were Hispanic in 2017. At UCF, that number is even lower. 4% Black and 4% Hispanic.
Well, that has me thinking back to something that UCF professor Pamela McCauley said earlier about women in engineering schools not having a role model and how that could be a factor in why they're leaving the industry.
Exactly. It's the reason why diversity in both gender and ethnicity is important to Elizabeth Dooley. She's the dean of the College of Undergraduate Studies at UCF.
And so why is it important? It's not only important for the individuals who are of color. We pride ourselves as a university saying that voices matter, information matters, perspectives matter. And if we're preparing our students for a world, we're not a one culture world.
Now, UCF is working to increase what they call underrepresented minorities. That's faculty that identifies as Black, American Indians, Alaskan Native, and Hispanic. And they're doing it on two fronts. One is recruiting more, so getting more faculty into the door. And another is retention, keeping those faculty in positions. But one thing I found in these records is that there's a clear salary gap.
One thing that I'm finding interesting here is this isn't exactly what you set out to investigate, right?
Exactly. That's the thing about public records requests, right? One request leads to half a dozen or more stories. So in 2017, the average salary of UCF engineering and computer science faculty was about $119,000. That's all instructional faculty, professors, assistant professors, associate professors, lecturers, etc. The average white salary was the same, about $119,000, Asian, $124,000. Now let's drill down to those underrepresented minorities. The average Black faculty member salary last year, $106,000. Hispanic, $97,000. That's roughly $20,000 a year less than the average. And the data from FSU had around the same gap, but we focused on UCF because we had more data to work with.
Right. That seems like a substantial difference in salary. What seems to be the reasoning behind it, Brendan?
UCF's Office of Diversity and Inclusion recognizes the gaps, and the office is holding an equal pay day next month to bring more attention to the issue. As for the cause, McCauley, who I should mention is Black, says it's a systemic issue. Promotion throughout the academic system, which would mean a pay increase, is peer-driven.
And we know, demographically speaking, that those people are not underrepresented minorities, or women. So oftentimes you have inherent bias that is well at play, and there have been enough number of studies done to show that this is real. It's just evidence of clear, indisputable evidence of bias, and we have a responsibility to do something about that.
I will say the data that I pulled was over a five-year period, and that gap over time is closing. So UCF takes faculty diversity very seriously. So Dean Elizabeth Dooley says the school as a whole wants to get 25% of its faculty to be from underrepresented minority groups in the next 2 years. Right now, she says the university is at about 20%.
So we're optimistic that we're making gains. And again, one of the things that's unique about UCF is that there is a sense and a feeling of having a social responsibility to do what's right for our students.
And because these records are easily accessible by anyone, journalists and anyone in the community, to keep tabs on these institutions and hold them accountable to those goals is easily accessible. For this particular record search, there was a fee. In my case, the University of Central Florida charges me less than $50 to have someone gather the data. So the accessibility of these records mean journalists and the community can gain access to them. And my interview with Nicole Darden-Creston about the demographic makeup and salaries of college faculty first aired on 90.7 last March as part of our Sunshine Week series. Up next, an Orlando-based nonprofit focused on bringing down the cost of artificial limbs goes to the United Nations. Intersections back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Brendan Byrne, in for Matthew Petty. Albert Monero, who co-founded the nonprofit Limitless Solutions while still a student at UCF, spoke to the United Nations this week. Monero was part of a panel for International Day of Persons with Disabilities. We're going to listen back to an interview with Monero and Dr. Albert Chi about a clinical trial to test the next generation of 3D printed arms. Intersection's Matthew Petty spoke to Monero and Dr. Chi about the clinical trial back in May.
Albert Monero was an engineering student at the University of Central Florida when he heard a story on the radio about a 3D-printed prosthetic hand. That story sparked an idea for his research into prosthetic limbs. Now, more than 5 years later, Monero has a PhD under his belt, and his non-profit, Limitless Solutions, is embarking on a clinical trial to test the next generation of 3D-printed arms for kids with congenital limb loss. At the clinical trial unveiling at UCF, the engineering intern, Brooke Mansfield, demonstrated one of the prosthetic arms.
We're looking at an older model of one of the 3D-printed arms. Just describe it for our listeners.
This is one of our old Iron Man arms. It's one of the first ones that we made. And it's just kind of showing how far we've come from this to the new original design we just announced.
It looks pretty tough.
Yeah, it's very durable.
So how do you make it move? You've got a couple of sensors attached to your upper arm there, and when you flex a muscle, the fingers move. How does that work?
So we use EMG technology, which is electromyography. So we put two sensors on a muscle and one on a different muscle. And when you flex your muscle, it triggers a response in the arm, which causes the gesture to occur, which in this case is opening or closing the hand. So when you flex again, it would close.
How much training do you need to flex the muscle the right amount and make the fingers close?
Well, it takes the kids about 15 minutes from when they get it to be able to use it pretty well.
That's it? 15 minutes?
Yeah. It's really not difficult to learn. But we have made the video game to help them learn faster and get better at it, especially for when we move to multi-gesture arms.
Limitless and UCF teamed up with Oregon Health and Science University for the trial.
Dr. Albert Chi, trauma surgeon at Oregon Health and Science University and the clinical collaborator for this trial.
I'm Albert Monero, engineering PhD and president of Limitless Solutions.
So this is a fully funded trial for 20
initial children in the pilot study. And yes, based on like philanthropic and corporate support, we've been able to fully fund the first study.
How expensive is it? Like, how much money are we talking about here?
Our initial projections are that the clinical trial, which runs the course of a year, it has four visits for each kid, represents about $10,000. And so about $1,000 of that is in the hardware for the arm, some of the manufacturing time as added then onto it. And then there's funds in there for their travel stipend, as well as the occupational therapy. And then a little bit of miscellaneous, because we know that this is our first time doing this and making sure that we're prepared. The advanced prosthetic limbs on the market are quite expensive, and that's a huge limitation both for doctors and insurance companies to want to provide them for children. And we're looking to try to change that paradigm.
Dr. Chi, what does it mean, sort of being able to get that cost bar down?
I mean, really, the amazing thing that Albert and Limitless and his organization has done is really coming up with what I call an advanced prosthetic using 3D printing technology. And the price point is a little staggering. The traditional prosthetics out there can be up to hundreds of thousands of dollars. Not only that, even with people with good insurance, reimbursement may be difficult. And sometimes even over a lifetime, you only have the opportunity for one reimbursement. Even with good coverage, there may be a certain percentage that is out of pocket, and often that time, that's also rate limiting for them. So to be able to have something that is so affordable and accessible, it really is kind of a game changer for everybody.
So what kind of technology or what kind of technological advances are you checking out with this clinical trial?
Well, currently we're using muscle activity, EMG signals. The traditional 3D printed prosthetics were body powered. So just the fact that we're using EMG powered 3D printed prosthetic devices, that's a huge advancement. This new design also is capable of having multiple gestures. So even compared to commercially available hands that are out there now, I mean, there it's going head to head.
So for the old 3D printed arms, you'd basically just have to learn how to move your shoulder or what have you to get the limb to respond?
Yeah, traditionally a lot of the 3D printed parts that you see out in the news or around the country have been body powered. Limitless has been really focused on making that electromyography or EMG experience for kids, which really gives them the full like biosensing. EMG basically works as when you flex your muscles, they generate a voltage just like a battery. We can read that with like the same stickers that go into like an EKG for your heart and be able to tell the hand to open and close. And this new device that we're working on has the ability to not only do open and close, but individual finger dexterity. And that's where the training system via the video games comes in to really teach kids how to use their arm while they feel like they're playing a game.
What does the game look like? I mean, how are you training these kids, or how will you be training these kids to use these things?
So in the game, there's a character that has superpowers, and depending on how hard you flex their muscles, the character in the game does different superpowers. And that helps us be able to basically put the patterns in there that will have the multifunction gestures in their arm and then let them be able to pattern that. So that's the first game, and we're looking at other games for specific pattern training as well.
How complex is the mechanics of the arm? Are there little electric motors that are powering the fingers?
Yes, each finger has its own motor. It uses one battery pack for the whole thing. And what's really unique about this one, using 3D printing and our own electronics, the weight point of the arm is less than a pound and a third right now. So it's exceptionally light compared to a traditional prosthetic.
Which would make a huge difference for kids, I imagine.
It's the number one thing you can hear from kids is that they wish their arm was a little bit lighter.
So, I mean, how much of an advance is this over, say, what prosthetic limbs looked like 5 years ago.
I have to tell you, the design that Limitless has put out today is very comparable as far as functionality to commercially available advanced prosthetics now. Now, the advantage that we have is its beautiful artistic design. If you just look at the limb and when the children experience that, it truly is an experience. Their faces light up and they just cannot wait to don that device. And we talk about the long-term psychosocial benefits of using one of the Limitless devices, but I got to tell you, those effects are immediate. And that's something that makes this arm so unique, is that versatility and aesthetic appeal that it really has for all the children, from, you know, fun, almost action hero type themes to elemental themes to very elegant themes as well that are both male and female friendly. Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering why you decided to narrow the trial down to kids who were born with the limb loss. Like, what was the rationale for that?
You know, we really wanted to focus on a special patient group that we knew could benefit, and especially with pediatrics, with how rapidly they're growing, that many times that traditional prosthetics really isn't an option. And the project initially was founded on when 3D printed first started for a child with congenital limb loss, and we've kind of remained true to that theme. Mm-hmm.
There must be Albert Monero kids or parents or patients beating a path to your door, though, saying, you know, maybe if they lost their limb in an accident, they must be very interested in this research too.
We've had so many families from not only the United States, but really around the world. I think about 60 countries are represented in those request lists. And it actually all started because there was an interview on NPR here in Orlando with Ivan Owen, who is one of the original inventors of a 3D printed mechanical hand. And I was driving to work here in Orlando. I heard it on the radio and I came into my research lab and I was like, I really want to be a part of this. And now fast forward, like basically 5 years later, this represents kind of the cutting edge in 3D printed advanced prosthetics.
You were involved in 3D printing technology before you got involved in the Limitless project, or before you started that project?
I had some experience through my high school had a 3D printer, and then UCF, of course, has several 3D printers. And so I knew what technology was available there. And then once we found there was a local family in need that needed a bionic arm, now Alex Pring, once that all kind of came together, we just really went with the resources that were available, and it just kind of snowballed to here.
What happens at the end of the clinical trial? I heard you make some remarks in the press conference there talking about getting FDA approval. Is that the next big hurdle?
So the first study, our goal is just to get the ball rolling. Our goal is to have a lot more kids in studies all around the country, and to be able to take all of that data in a few years and demonstrate it to the FDA for full market clearance. And then we can really show the results to the insurance companies of how important this is for kids' development, and whether that's psychosocial or for any type of physiological growth, and then be able to get them to meet these kids where they are and be the hero for them to make this possible.
So FDA approval could be some years down the track?
It's going to take some time. The goal is, under the clinical trial, we're going to learn a lot and keep advancing, and then keep working one step at a time towards that.
What's it like for a child learning to use one of these, just having to sort of learn how to use this technology and incorporate it into their daily life?
Yeah, one of the first things I tell the children is that they are perfect as they are. And the devices are a tool for them to use as they wish. And it's really there to help improve their lives. And it doesn't mean they need to use it or force them to use it. The wonderful thing is that they've made the device so fun that the children want to use it. And part of the clinical collaboration is really that rehab expertise, that on the initial visit, we have hand therapists that work with the children to go beyond the initial kind of wow factor, but really work on activities of daily living. We provide therapy, adaptive equipment to them in order for them to do bimanual tasks like cutting their food or transferring objects between hands and things. And we do routine follow-up, which we're planning to do in this clinical trial, which I feel as though is crucial for long-term acceptance of prosthetic devices. Mm-hmm.
There's obviously some advances in this limb compared to the previous models you've had. What's the next step, though? Is it trying to build some sensation into the digits or into the palm of the hand?
It's definitely something we're working on. We're trying to always make that experience better. And so Different types of feedback for kids so they know how hard they're closing the arm or what they're touching are always kind of on our horizon. We have a couple other projects in mind using similar EMG technology, such as our bionic wheelchair that you drive with your face muscles. It has huge applications, we think, for people with like quadriplegic cases or neuromuscular disorders. So all that's in the lab and kind of ongoing. But today we're really excited to hone in on how this clinical trial is going to provide this opportunity for kids.
And the fact that, you know that it's a prosthetic, you're not trying to disguise that or make it look like somebody's actual limb. How big of a brainwave was that, realizing that it can be a prosthetic and we can kind of celebrate that fact?
So that actually came about because the kids told us that they would rather look like superheroes or their favorite fashion design. Originally, we thought that they'd want to blend in, and then we learned that it's actually an expression point for them, and it's a tool. And so with our partnership with the Arts College here, being able to get that beautiful expressive themes, and this new arm, it's the most advanced expression we've been able to get. And then we had the engineering side, and now really bringing in the medical clinical experience that OHSU has. It's just helping us get that full picture to really impact kids' lives.
Do you see people printing these at home one day?
So that's a regulatory question for the government agencies. I know that the FDA is working through how they want to regulate 3D printed medical devices. We've shared some of our information, and they now have some like non-binding resolutions. And so we're always working with the regulatory bodies to make sure that we're following the best practices, and we'll see where the future goes in terms of regulatory as the technology continues to like stride faster and faster.
I mean, that sounds like the official answer, but what do you want to see, Albert Monero? Because, like, I mean, the idea of a 3D printer is it distributes the power of building these things to the people, right? Is that what you would like to see at some point in the future?
So our goal is always about accessibility, and so people being able to work on these in their own locale is obviously the important part. But we balance that with, like, we really want the quality to be there and for the experience. And right now we know that the medical institution that's being able to support this provides a really good quality of care for the training, because it's one thing to have the bionic arm, it's another thing about how you use it, and that's where the professionals are going to be able to really help. We've been working on this idea for about 5 years total. Limitless has been around for just under four, and at one point we actually drove up to Dr. Chi's former hospital over our spring break, because we were all students, to show him our tech and some of the advancements. And so to go from that like student spring break type project to being here today, being able to collaborate together and seeing those kids' smiles light up when they see the new arms that they might be able to apply for, it's unbelievable. I'm so happy.
Dr. Chi, what does it mean to you?
You know, I really do believe this is the first step of the evolution of 3D printed prosthetics. Not only 3D printed prosthetics, but the next generation of prosthetics overall. And the work that Albert and Limitless have been doing over the last 5 years have been so impressive. That's why we've maintained this relationship over the years and everything. I think this is the beginning of something incredible, and we're witnessing the future.
Well, Dr. Albert Chi is overseeing the clinical trial of these new prosthetic limbs. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
And Albert Monero is the president of Limitless Solutions. Thank you as well, Albert.
Thank you for having us.
That interview first aired on Intersection last May. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Our intern is Shania Richburg. Subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're also on the NPR One app. Thanks to everyone who made a contribution during our successful fall silent drive. Your support keeps local programming like Intersection on the air and supports the in-depth space reporting you'll hear on my podcast, Are We There Yet? You'll also be supporting investigative journalism like Abe Abaraya's series with ProPublica on PTSD and first responders, and Amy Green's reporting on climate change. If you still want to make your year-end contribution, go to WMFE.org. I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.